This is Cheryl McQuaid with the Lansing Fisher Body Historical Team. It's January 6, 2006. It's approximately 8:30 a.m. We're at the greenhouse preparing to interview Renita Taylor. First, we'll identify everybody else in the room.
Marilyn Coulter.
Earl Nicholson.
Jerry Smith.
John Fidua.
Renita, would you please state your name and spell your last name for us?
Renita Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R.
And what is your address?
I live at 16916 Ingersoll Road, Lansing, Michigan.
Are you married?
No, divorced.
Any children?
One daughter, one stepson.
What did your parents do?
My father was a butcher by trade, and my mother did Stanley Home Products and worked in a little Pennywise, which is similar to a Woolworths, back in Endicott, New York.
And so you were born in New York?
I was born and raised, graduated from high school in Endicott, New York. Came out here in 1972, January of 72, because my new husband, who I married in 71, had an older brother already established out here, so came out here so he'd have a job.
And could you give us a little bit on your educational background?
Yeah, I graduated from Union Endicott High School in Endicott, New York, and I have taken numerous college credit courses. I should really get together with somebody and figure out where I'm at as far as a degree goes, because over the years I've taken an awful lot.
And any military background?
No.
Why did you come to Fisher Body for employment?
In November of 1980, I was laid off from my then job, Cook Harriman Volkswagen Volvo Mazda. And on February 21st of 1981, after having been laid off for 3 months, my neighbor called me on a Sunday morning, and she had already been employed at Fisher Body for 10 years or so, and said she knew that I was looking for a job and that they were hiring. So I gathered up my sister, and the two of us went and stood in the line at the south lot for about 6 hours in the freezing, sleety rain, and we both got hired. Started March 27th, 1981.
Do you remember that first day?
I certainly do. There was about 200 of us that hired in to populate the night shift, second shift out in C-trim. And the thing that impressed me the most was how huge the building was. Seeing trains inside of the building, just, I was in awe. It was remarkable.
And you hired in on second shift?
On the second shift.
What department?
Trim, C-trim.
Do you remember the job that they put you in?
Yeah, I was hired in on utility.
What is utility?
Which is absentee replacement. I was told to learn all the jobs in the supervisor's area. And at that time, it was actually two supervisors' areas. It was anything that included the urethane jobs, which was back glass, front windshields. And the line came out of paint. The first part was a urethane area. Then it went down and swept around, and they put vinyl tops in. So some back glass couldn't be put in till after the vinyl tops were on. So once you got back down to the other end towards the paint chute, that was considered urethane again. And they put some back glass in back there. And that's what I hired in on.
So you had a large area of jobs to learn.
Right.
How many jobs?
Oh, God. I couldn't tell you for sure. I'd have to think about all the jobs that were in those two areas. But what was funny was that I was told I had to learn all the jobs except urethane by George Burdett because I was left-handed and all the guns that you used to put the urethane on the glass were right-handed. Well, in those days, they did swap, and after about, I don't know, a month, Verland Ward came to the night shift and said, how many jobs you know? I said, all of them. He says, all of them? Well, except urethane. And he says, go learn it. I said, well, George told me I didn't have to learn it because all the guns are right-handed. Go learn it. So it took me about a month, and I learned it. I was covered from head to foot in urethane for a while, but I got it.
What did you think of the supervisors then?
Oh, they were a different crew back then. There was a lot more power on the floor. If they gave you a decision, it stood. None of what goes on now that the first line supervisors, they don't give you an answer. They have to go check with their boss. you know, you can't even give, there's no use even presenting a grievance at the first step to a supervisor today because they won't answer it. They have to go get an answer from their boss. Back then, the supervisors, even though they were, you know, the old school where they might want to burn you just for looking crosswise at them, they had some integrity. They said what they meant, and they meant what they said.
Do you remember any of the people that you hired in around?
Oh, yeah. Sure. Kendra Bailey, hired in the same day as I did. Jean Wicker, Shannon Cole. And I can tell you, the people almost out of the chute, everybody that was in that area. Wayne Duncan and the windshield guys were Jimmy Locke and Gail Crandall, who doesn't work there any longer. Who else was it? Oh, what was her name? Tina Snyder. There was Diane Speckine and Donna Holbrook, Linda Johnson. Let's see, who else? Oh, Marty Plowman, Doug Young, George Uriales. Animal, which is Jim Skazwak, was our pickup man, which is equivalent today to a coordinator. There was a ton of people. That was a big area.
What did you think about the people you worked around?
Well, I immediately liked them, everybody. I'm kind of a social person anyways, but just having that common thread, which the sense of equality that you only find in a unionized shop. It's not like where I had worked previously. Somebody had status, if you will, if they were, you know, the parts manager or the service manager versus a common mechanic or the office manager versus a receptionist. Everybody was the same.
Marilyn Coulter.
That was part of my question. Since you obviously just got through telling us what the management was like at the previous plant that you were in, how were the people different from your co-workers in the Mazda facility? And also, what did you know difference about the two cultures?
Well, it wasn't a Mazda facility. It was Cook, Harriman, Volkswagen, Volvo, Mazda dealership.
Oh, okay.
And I hired in there as a receptionist, I was a service writer, and then one day the owner walked up to me and said, go back and run the body shop. He was the boss. You did what he told you. I worked in the office. There, as I said, the structure was a little different. If you were the office manager, although you might have been my friend, there was a status thing. Mm-hmm. If you were a mechanic versus the service manager, service writers were considered a little bit above the, the oil change boy. But when you walked in the doors at Fisher Body, everybody was the same.
How did it work for you going from being like an office manager to working on an assembly line? What was it like for you to work on an assembly line?
It didn't really bother me in any way other than eventually any job gets boring. For me, it's always been the social, the people, meeting new people and exchanging ideas. So, I really thought for the amount of money we made, which was $9.32 an hour when I hired in, it was great. I couldn't believe it. I had been doing what I'd been doing and being required to work on Saturdays when the salespeople were there, just an awful lot of responsibility without the pay at my former place, place of employment, so I was tickled pink to get hired in.
So, what was it like to work on the night shift inside Fisher Body?
Aside from the fact that I had a 9-year-old daughter, it made it very difficult for her formative years to be stuck on the night shift, I actually enjoy night shift better.
What made you enjoy it better?
Well, I think, first of all, there's way too many big cheeses walking around on the day shift. They're stumbling over themselves, and I've always felt management was top-heavy. They leave you alone, obviously, on the night shift. There's a lot less of them. You can make a decision on the night shift and get something done a lot better than you can on the day shift. And for me personally, I think if you work the night shift, you have the whole day to take care of things. Now today, everything's open 24 hours, but 25 years ago, they weren't. And if you had business to take care of, you had to take care of it on the day shift. So if you were a day shift employee, it was hard to get anything done. That's why there was even provisions in our local agreement for doctors' appointments, etc., because day shifters had to do it on the day shift.
Cheryl McQuaid, how old were you when you hired in?
28.
So, this might be tough for Nita, but could you think about when you first hired in, walking into the plant, what a typical day was like for somebody in extra board and utility?
They had a process that you reported to the supervisor's office, and you didn't even necessarily have to talk to the supervisor, because anybody who wanted the day off at that time went in and wrote their name on a piece of paper. So the utility people knew, and usually the supervisor would tell you, hey, Susie, Bobby, and Tom are going home. Those are the three jobs you have to cover. And then amongst themselves, the utility people would say, okay, I'll take Bobby's job, you take Susie's job, so-and-so takes Timmy's job. And that worked pretty well in most areas, unless you got a supervisor who decided they preferred a person, a personal friend or whatever, and then they allowed them to take the favored job every time. And that was changed and addressed in the 87 negotiations local agreement to rotate utility to alleviate that disparity.
Do you remember who trained you on some of the jobs that you had to learn?
Well, the employees were trained you. Each individual job, Diane Speckeen taught me how to put back moldings on the cutlasses back in those days on the right-hand side, or excuse me, the left-hand side of the car, and Donna Holbrook on the left, or excuse me, right. And each employee, when you went to learn urethane, you had to get Craig Johnson out of the way. He hired in the same day as me. Out of the way, and he'd show you, you'd try to run a practice glass, etc. So the employees taught you.
Do you have any other family members that work at Fisher Body?
Yeah, I have a younger sister that works in the body shop.
And oh, that's right, she hired in with you.
She has 2 days more seniority than me. And she didn't want to get out of bed that day.
What was it like standing in that line for 6 hours?
Well, it was, for me, it was just hopeful. I was a single mother, I was getting no child support, and I was working for $5.65 an hour before I had gotten laid off 6 weeks before Christmas. So I was hopeful and desperate and hoping that I'd get the job. I didn't care, it was cold. It was an opportunity for me.
Did you meet many people in that line?
No, not really, just the common, how long have you been standing here, you know. Did you know anybody, because the rumors had been about you could go, if you knew somebody and knew a supervisor, et cetera, they'd pull your card, your application, but just general conversation.
Marilyn Coulter. RT, you came in the 80s. There are some certain things about you that we'll get into later that had that, but during your time there, what were some of the biggest environmental or working conditions that changed over those from there to 2007?
The one that sticks out in my head the most is that back when I hired in, there was no ergonomic matting. Now, when you stood and built windshields all day, that was down on the concrete, and I can tell you that my legs hurt for about 6 weeks, and I was in really good physical condition as a tennis player. They hurt for 6 weeks until it finally hit me. It was standing on the concrete. And today there's very few spots that doesn't have the ergonomic, or at least before the plant went down, that didn't have ergonomic matting. Made all the difference in the world.
Well, and you just said something. Before you, so I'm going to digress a little bit. Before coming into the Fisher Body plant, had you heard anything about the plant or Fisher Body before you came in?
Yeah, of course. Just like everybody out there now that has no experience with actually being an auto worker. I heard the overpaid, beer drinking, lowlifes, etc. And within a couple of weeks, I realized how hard the people really worked and what a toll it would take on your body over a period of time, which it has on an awful lot of people that are now up there close to my age. There was a lot of drinking, there was a lot of drugs in the 80s, way worse than it is today. But I think part of that was just the monotony of it. But the jobs, most of those jobs really do take a toll on you. You earn your money.
Were there other things about the people, your coworkers, that the public might have believed about them, but you found that was untrue?
Another thing that I remember really distinctly was the impression before you go in there is that everybody's uneducated, illiterate. And just in my own area, I know Linda Johnson, who's been our newspaper editor for, I would say it was probably 84 when Louis Schultz put her on that job. When I hired in, she was on the line putting on front windshield moldings, and she had a degree in journalism. There was an attorney who's no longer there. I can see him right in front of me. I'll come up with it in a minute. There was a couple of attorneys, actually. There was quite a few educated people who chose to come in there just because the wages and benefits were so good. And they were a lot of educated people. Dave Brown has a degree.
Mm-hmm. So I know that you said that there were some drugs, there were some drinking. What types of things did you, when you were working on the average day, did you notice any pranks or things? What types of things do people do to get them through their day other than maybe drinking an occasional drug?
Oh, well, when it was hot in the summertime, we had water fights. No question about that, because I had a guy come up with a butt can one time, a big 5-gallon butt can full of water, and threw it at me across the car and hit me. Well, that was, as I said earlier, that was before you could put the back glass in. It had to go to vinyl tops. Well, by the time it got to vinyl tops, which was, 60 yards away, they couldn't put the vinyl top on, so they had to stop the line because that car was full of water. And naturally, nobody knew who did what to anybody, but I was standing there covered with water. Yeah, they'd do pranks and stuff like that. That was fun.
Were there other things? I know that they had things like implant vending and...
Implant vending?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you had people like Daryl Mangles that would go around and sell pop and ice cream in the summertime and sandwiches. And you had Daryl Brunner that was always running one raffle after another. There was all kinds of people. Terry... Oh, what was his last name? Terry. Remember he got caught in the scam that he raffled off a car and then he ended up giving it to his own cousin or brother? Oh, I can't think of his last name. Anyways, there was always somebody trying to run some scam, making money, extra money.
There were different things. Now, one thing that I know about you is that you became union active in the plant, and you moved up quite the ladder. What made you want to become involved in your local union, and how did you want to tell us a little bit about how that happened and some of the changes you were able to make happen for your coworkers on the floor?
Well, Gary Bernath doesn't like me telling this story, but he's the reason why I ran for election the first time, because back in 83, I was on utility still, and George Burdett walked up to me and told me, report over to Ken DeRosa's area, the next area over. I said, why? The contract says the low man gets reassigned, which I'd already read our local agreement. And he said, I don't care what it says, get over there. Well, of course, I put a committee call in. My committee man at that time was Joe Cerna, but Gary Bernath was the alternate. So Gary Bernath came out, and I explained the situation to him, that I wasn't the lowest seniority, because Tim, even though he had 78 corporate seniority, had come over from the parts plant. So at that time, remember our separate seniority? We had corporate seniority, you had in-plant seniority. Gary went away and was gone a couple hours and came back and told me that, no, that's the way it is, RT, and I just knew that that was wrong. And I thought, well, I could do a better job. So When the next election came up, about 3 months later, I ran. And to my advantage, Joe Cerna had gotten disciplined for being drunk in the plant. Got a week off about 1 week before the election, and there were six of us running. So I just squeaked by 36-30 was my first election.
And it was your first election, but now, with you being a female, were there many females who were committee representatives?
When I first got elected in 83, no, there wasn't. It was all men on the night shift. But I was thinking about that on the way over here. In the 86 elections, there was a lot of women. Elaine Lee was a district committee person. Debbie McNichols, day shift paint, or Debbie Clements today. Barb Johnson was Dick Bennett's alternate. Marcia Raglia, remember Marcia Sobleski, and she got married, Marcia Raglia? She was a full-time committee man. What's her name? I can see her right in front of me. In QC. Beautiful black woman. Hazel.
Hazel.
Hazel. So back then, up in 86, there was quite a shift. All of a sudden, you had 5-6 women that were in positions, elected positions.
And even though the population, which was predominantly men, elected you, how did that work for you and the other women?
I don't think it bothered me at all, because I've always been kind of tomboyish. I think there was a definite sexism that you could feel, and some people were blatant about it. Well, you don't belong in that job. That's a man's job, with some of the old-timers. But the people out on the floor certainly accepted it fine. They didn't have a problem with it. And in fact, I'm not trying to take credit for it, but I think it might have shown some of these other women that they could, in fact, run and get elected, because 3 years later, quite a few did run and did get elected.
So were there specific things that you remember as far as helping the work life of the employees, that things that you knew as an employee needed to be worked on that you were able to help change?
Oh, I'd like to think I did that on a daily basis. I mean, I know I complained today that the way I was taught, and that was under Ron McKeever, was my zone at the time, that you check your book every hour on the hour. If there's nothing there, okay, you can sit in the work center, but you better go check it every hour. And the attitude today is, oh, we have 3 days to get a committee call, which is nowhere in writing anywhere. So my point being that we were on top of what was going on. We stuck together. If there was an issue up in paint, there was many times us trimmers, Dick Bennett, myself, Ron Perry, would go walking up into the paint department to show a strength, a sense of unity that we're the union and this is not going to happen to our people. Whether it was heat relief, even though I'm a district committee man down in trim, we're marching up to paint. I used to write health and safety grievances all the time. You know, remember, rarely the line stopped. Well, one time it did stop, and I was right out there watching. All of a sudden it started a minute or so later, and somebody almost got knocked over by an open door. And I wrote that to Tom Roth, was the MC at the time, and got it in writing that they would announce before they ever started up the line again that the line would be started up. So we were doing that on a constant basis. If there was a fire in the body shop, we would all tear out down to the body shop.
Can you explain to us what a heat relief is?
Yeah, in the paint department, they had an agreement that if it got over 88 degrees in the clean rooms, they were given additional relief, time away from the job. So paint department historically carried additional relief people for that purpose. Well, of course, management would always argue when it was implemented. We finally, I can't remember what year this actually went down in writing, but it ended up being put in writing like May 15th, and it ended September 15th. But for years, you had to argue over, it's extremely hot up there, give them some additional relief. And you'd have to argue they'd want to pull the relief people out early when you know there's obviously some hot days still in September. But that was to give them some, what's the word I'm looking for? Break from the excessive heat that was generated because those clean rooms were right off the ovens.
Now, you became a union member and a union leadership in the 80s, right?
Yes.
And during that time, that's when as far as industry change, they started coming up with a lot of different projects and programs that got the hourly rank and file line worker employee involved. Were you instrumental in any of those programs? What did you think about it? Did it change the environment that we worked in?
Yeah, I was still on the line. I got elected in June of 83 the first time, and I remember Dean Crosston walked up to Indian, who's Jerry,
Van Alstyne.
Van Alstyne. There you go. Oh, I was going to say A name. Jerry Van Alstyne. And said, hey, we got a new program. You want to be the EPG leader? And I listened for a minute. And he explained that it was called the Employee Participation Group Leader and that people were supposed to elect their own out of a supervisor's area, et cetera. And I'm listening to this whole explanation as he's asking a guy, does he want to be it? So Jerry said yes, he took the job. And I knew right then it was just one more program of the month. And then, of course, once I got elected, they sent us to this program was under the QWL, Quality Work Life, umbrella, and it was in the 84 National Agreement, and it used to talk about improving the quality of work life of employees, and it talked about equality of sacrifice between management and union workers. That has since dropped from the contract, and in subsequent years they've altered it a little, but, you know, they had the Main Street School in 84 when the conversion from the Cutlass and the 98s and 88s happened to building the NCAR, the Grand Ams. They've had a program every couple of years, and it's not designed to do what it was intentionally or intended to do initially.
So, Renita, were you utility up to the point where you were elected as a committee person?
No, I was on utility about, 15 months in the summer of 82. They put me on station wagon side glass build and install.
And how long did you do that job?
Until they went away, actually. Actually, they went away before I got elected. I was on the line on utility again. We only ran them for not quite a year. Those station wagons, remember that?
You're right.
And what did you think about being a committee person? Did you enjoy that job?
I loved it. In all the jobs I've ever done, it was the hardest I ever worked. You had more responsibility. I got pages at all hours of the night and day, calls, phone calls at home and on the weekends. But I liked learning anyway. So for me, in the free time, it was sitting down reading umpire decisions, reading the back of the national agreement, the different documents and appendix letters and the educational outlines, went over all the memos that had ever been written, comparing one contract to the next, what they got, etc. So I loved that job. I loved writing the contentions. In all the time, for what, 3 years, 4 years I was a district, I never had to run a grievance past the second step because I would write a contention. It's like a brief letter. And I would refer back to umpire decisions and research it, and I just had a good time.
Marilyn Coulter.
Now, you were a committee person, and you were also a zone. Can you tell, for those people who don't know, can you tell the difference between a committee person and a zone as far as their jobs or responsibilities?
Sure. A committee person, you're elected by up to 250 people in a given geographic area, and your responsibilities start at the beginning of the shift. Actually, they've changed it now in the national agreement. Prior to two back, I think it was 99 agreement, prior to then, you were technically supposed to be on the line the first hour of the shift and the first half hour after lunch. Locally, we never did that, so it was understood that you didn't go out on the floor for the first hour at the beginning of the shift and the first half hour. But as soon as your hour was up, back when I was a committee man, we all headed out, checked our respective books, and started taking committee calls. And it was nothing to have 20, 25 committee calls a day and got them all in a given day. you referred people to the EAP, which was a fairly new program back then. We only had Ralph Begg, and Louis Schultz was a chairman in 84, and he appointed Ralph Begg, so it was a fairly new program.
What was EAP?
Employee Assistance Program. At the time, with very little knowledge about the drug problem in the work environment or out in the world, it was basically dedicated to alcoholism. And it grew. I think it was 86 they put Mark LaPorte on the night shift. And that was... and around that same time, Martha Adams went on, and within a year or two, the chaplaincy program went on. Louis Schultz initiated a lot of programs back then, between 84 and 87, those 3 years right in there. But a zone, your responsibilities are entirely different. You get elected plant-wide, and although you're given a specific area, whether it be the body shop, paint department, trim department, the only reason why you don't service someone, say if I'm the trim zone and a body shopper walks in the work center, is basically out of courtesy to the other zone who is supposedly representing them. But many times we did do that. We'd cross over. Your responsibility as a zone is basically to process grievances at the set once they hit the step and a half, which is a local that's not in the national agreement. It's a step that we've developed at our location that kind of gets an awful lot of stuff settled before you have to reduce it to writing at the second step and exchange contentions, etc. So a zone goes into the step and a halves, and if need be, then of course he has to write the contention and pursue the grievance to the second step. A zone sits on the bargaining committee, so a lot of times I kind of had the reputation for being the memo queen, kind of sarcastically, because oftentimes, no matter how good a job you try to do during negotiations, you overlook something, or something comes up between contract years. So I would go to management and say, you recognize this is a problem, I recognize this is a problem, it's not specifically addressed in the local or national agreement, so let's get a memorandum of understanding together. And then you would reduce it to writing, you'd sign it, and you'd present it at the union meeting, and it became part of your local agreement. You would research issues that were broad in nature, such as hospital calls. It wasn't something specific to your own zone. Maybe I'm a trim zone, but people that come from the body shop and go to the hospital have the same issues. So you'd research, generic issues, things that affected everybody. But the immediate relationship with the people out on the floor isn't there as a zone like it is as a district. And I missed that. I really enjoyed being the district. I liked them both, but the district was actually the hardest job I've ever done.
Cheryl McQuaid, you said that as a district you would get typically 25 calls a night. What type of calls would you get? What were some of the problems?
Well, there were things back then, like I said initially, the supervisors, they might have been old school, well, where they would have the union ain't telling me what to do, and maybe you just negotiated something in the new 84 agreement, local agreement. They didn't know about it, they didn't care about it, so they were going to violate it regardless. For instance, under this is actually a national agreement, it says once an employee puts in a committee call, they will be sent for immediately, the committee person will be sent for immediately, and no discussion. Well, when you report in a given area, a supervisor's area, and say, hey, I want Joe Schmo, I'm here for a committee call, and they tell you, well, no, I got him over there doing repair. No, your committee calls get top priority, and that's by agreement. So I would get that a lot, where a supervisor felt that their obligation to supplement the repair people. Remember, we used to have Group 20 and Group 25, the hard trim repair and soft trim repair. Well, I'd have a pickup man down doing repair work. So there might be 7 or 8 calls out of that area because they wanted their committee call, and either the supervisor said, well, you can't have one. That was another thing they'd like to say because they felt that they could discuss it. And, they just had a different attitude back then. A lot of them might be safety issues, A lot of times back in those days, supervisors would threaten people. So I get a lot of committee calls.
Marilyn Coulter.
Do you have what you would call, like, during your time, as that a happiest moment, a saddest moment?
I don't know. I'm kind of pretty a steady person and can take pretty much everything in stride. The moment that sticks out in my mind is in September of 92 when we went on strike, and when we walked out that front door, I just can't explain it to you, the overwhelming sense of responsibility that when you're on strike, you're actually out of a job. And when you walk people out, I know the attitude is, all right, finally giving them hell. But it was overwhelming for me to think that, my God, I'm really helping put 4,000 people out of... I mean, I thought we would win and so on, but if you really understand how serious it really is, that was just overwhelming to know that I was walking 4,000 people out of the plant. That's when I started smoking again.
What about one of your happiest moments?
Well, I don't know about happiest moments, because like I said, to me it was all, there's certain little victories that I remember.
One that stands out that you're really...
Well, the one that stands out in my mind is in the 93 negotiations when they brought in Tom Tivier's Princeton master's degree, 28 years old, in labor relations to whip our butts, because... You know, management does go to school. They're very well-trained labor relations staff, and they assume that we're all uneducated idiots and can't hold our own with them. So they brought this hotshot in, and that's when they wanted to go to full team build. Well, we designed the first time build program, and we got there, but then he started really, we thought we were over with. We were done, and he really, really said, hey, look, they're going to close this plant, et cetera, you know, the threats coming like they've always been if we don't have full team build. And we'd argued it so many times. Dick Bennett went to open his mouth. He was the chairman at the time. And I said, he was sitting next to me. I said, Dick, can I say something? He said, yeah, go ahead. So I just leaned across the table. I said, Tom, you know what? I think you better find a way to tell Detroit that this is what's good for this plant, because it's not going to happen. And guess what? If this plant goes down, you're out of a job. And I pointed to each one of them successively, John Coothan and Mary Watson, and you're out of a job, and you're out of a job, and you're out of a job too. So save your threats. It's not going to happen. Well, he flushed beat red, and they called for a recess, but then they came back in and got off of it, and that was the end of that negotiations. And that felt good, because, you know, they love to do that. They love to threaten you. How many years did they threaten that they were going to close that plant? And I always said that they would not close that plant based on what type of local agreement we had here in Lansing. If you've got a board of directors sitting around in Detroit trying to decide whether you're going to spend $2 billion in Lansing, Michigan, they're going to say, hey, Joe Schmo, what'd you do on the federal government level for the EPA, air quality checks, et cetera? Oh, we, you know, did good. You're going to go, hey, Joe Schmo, how'd you get on tax abatements? What are you doing there? Oh, yeah, the city of Lansing's agreed to this and that. They're not going to say, hey, Joe Schmo, do they have team concept? That's not going to be a deciding factor in whether they invest $2 billion in Lansing, Michigan. So I was just sick to death of the threats, and I'd seen a few cave-ins prior to that when I wasn't in a position to stop it. That was a victory as far as I was concerned.
What did you feel...
Cheryl McCoy.
What did you feel made a good... supervisor? And what is the difference between supervisors then and now?
To me, integrity is number one. I don't care if you're going to disagree with me, if you're going to say, I don't think that job is too heavy, or if you're going to tell me, well, I think I need to burn that guy because I don't believe the reason why he's absent, if that's what you sincerely feel. Well, and back in the day, back in my day, that's the kind of answer you'd get. Now, you might have to fight like hell with that supervisor, but they were telling you what they really thought. Today, none of them make a decision on their own. They get direction from on high. And right before I lost in 96, my attitude was, don't take a first step grievance answer from a first line supervisor. Go take it right to the MC, and when they raise hell, what are you doing? You tell them, hey, you're giving them the answer anyways. And when I go to have a step and a half, I won't have it with you. I'm going to have it with a superintendent. And a few times I got a committee man who would do that, and it kind of helped a little bit. But ever since about 86, when the invasion of the, I say it, for me it started with Bud McCurdy coming over from the chassis side, trying to direct traffic, macro manage, you know, sit up here and tell everybody what to do down on the floor. That's the way they operate today, and it's not the way it's intended. It's not the way it's designed under the union agreement, and I think they let them get away with it way too often.
We're getting ready to go to a new plant. Mm-hmm. What do you think it's going to be like?
Well, I'm a little cynical because I've heard a lot of things I don't like, and matter of fact, I've heard things that would be illegal if they come to pass. But, you know, you hear stuff all the time, so I'm just kind of sitting, waiting to see what happens and how it's going to operate, because under law, some of the items I'm hearing, and some of the direction these new team leaders are supposed to, some of their job responsibilities, if they do what people are alleging they're going to be doing, it will be illegal. It won't be against a contract. It'll be illegal.
Earl Nicholson, are you talking about NLRB violations?
Yes.
Or UPL violations?
Yes, NLRB.
Okay.
What is NLRB?
National Labor Relations Board.
Politics plays a lot to do with that. Is it possible that one of the reasons that they think they can get away with it is because we have a Republican president and the NLRB is packed with pro-business would allow them to get away with UPLs?
Not in my opinion. I mean, there was Republican presidents during my tenure. Reagan was in. He fired the PATCO workers. Like they say, all politics is local. And you're only as strong as your weakest link. And if your leadership does not direct or teach the people that have the direct relationship with the supervisors on the floor, or if they're sitting in a room negotiating and agreeing to things without knowing that they're illegal, or you know, for just flat out saying, "Oh, I don't care if it's illegal, we're going to agree to this," that's where you have a problem. And I think that's the direction that has changed. The politics in that plant used to be, in my view, used to be directed towards impressing your constituents, and now they seem to be, everybody's impressing the leadership.
Jerry Smith, can you give us an example of things that you think are illegal?
Yeah, one thing, any condition of your employment, as far as your absenteeism, etc., has to be a supervisory function. And I have been told, and again, you hear a lot of things, that's why I'm cynical, but I'll have to wait and see, but I'm told that these team leaders will be taking attendance. They won't be taking attendance on me. They will know nothing about my attendance record. By law, that's a supervisory function. And that's the number one thing that I've heard from a lot of people that they're being directed that they would be doing.
And I've heard also, I don't know how true it is, that the group decides when you get to take a vacation. How is that going to work?
I hadn't heard that one, but I just, you know, you can model. General Motors can go and spend millions of dollars sending people all over the world into Japan to see how they function, to become more productive, etc. And maybe their manufacturing style includes some of these things. Doesn't mean they're legal. And it's up to our leadership to know the difference.
Marilyn Coulter.
RT, you had a model of three things that made a good union person, a good union leader, or the committee person. Can you share those things with us, and also, talk a little bit about that?
Well, I've always said that it takes three things to be a good union leader: knowledge, integrity, and guts. And integrity, I guess, is the bottom line, because I've had examples over the years, and you guys might know different people that didn't appear to be all that knowledgeable. I mean, they couldn't quote paragraph 62 says, like I might be able to do, but they knew it was somewhere in there. But they had integrity. They didn't lie for somebody. They didn't lie to management. And they had the guts enough to represent you at every turn. And in the other side of the coin, I've seen is, and as I was saying, on the other side, you can have somebody that doesn't appear to be, you know, stomping and screaming at management. And we know of one example of an excellent committee man by the name of Kenny Michaud, that the perception was, well, he's a milquetoast. Well, the guy made up in the area of stomping and screaming at management, he made up double in his ability to write contentions and make detailed records of what happened. But the guy had integrity. You can balance a little knowledge, you can balance a little guts, but if you don't have the integrity, you're just not going to be a good committee man, because you're not in there for the right reason. You're there to get off the line, or you're there on a power trip, or you're there just to play politics with your buddies, and that doesn't get the job done for the membership.
Earl Nicholson.
Okay, we've covered a lot about the external politics involving the UAW and General Motors. What I'd like to talk about a little bit right now would be the internal politics of the UAW specifically. And the follow-up question to that would be, how do they directly affect you?
Well, I've never, you know, if you define politics, it's called the art of persuasion. And I guess for a while I was able to persuade people that my way of thinking was the right way of thinking. And in the last 9-10 years, I've been unsuccessful, and other people have been successful. And that's politics. They have used whatever means necessary to gain power and maintain power. And, you know, there's been dirty politics. I've never subscribed to the idea of letters out on the floor, unsigned, and...
What is a letter out on the floor?
Well, you know, at election time, we've seen him. We've seen him as far back as Curly Jones. He had a bunch blasted at him, and I know who wrote them. And it's just not right. If you don't have the courage to address somebody either at a union meeting or man-to-man, face-to-face, then or sign your letter that you're trying to impress people, then you shouldn't do it. Unfortunately... I've had one directed at me, we all know that, in 96. And my first reaction to that letter, it was on a Saturday morning, my sister called me because the plant was working at 6 o'clock in the morning in the body shop. She called me at 6:15 in the morning and said, "You won't believe this," and read this god-awful letter to me. And my attitude was, nobody'd believe that. Well, that was kind of naive on my part, because, I mean, don't people read the National Enquirer? Don't people get the Globe? Don't they get the Star? Don't we listen to rumors and fight very hard not to pass them on? So that's what politics has become in the last few years. And not saying anything negative about Steve Bramos, but we all know that there was a campaign directed against Doug Taylor for a good 6-8 months. We will repay in May. We will repay in May. Unsigned letters coming out about once a week prior to the 2002 elections. Well, I don't think an election should be based on that. And shame on those people that do it. But there's a responsibility on the part of the voter, too, to check things out. And unfortunately, we don't do that. We don't do it in local politics, and we don't do it in national, state, and federal politics. We pick one idea, or we listen to what somebody else told us. We don't investigate on our own, and so we get stuck with who we have. I mean, how did the majority of people vote for George Bush? Hello? Mm-hmm.
So what was your position in the UAW when that unsigned letter came out?
I was a zone committee person, and I was running for chairman against Bob Grissom and Doug Taylor.
then what was the effect of that unsigned letter?
Well, the effect was I got squashed. I was soundly, soundly defeated. And it's actually reared its ugly head in several elections since then. I've had people still tell me that certain people that have maintained power pull that letter out every May, every time there's an election.
Cheryl McQuaid, Renita, you kind of touched on it. Rumors in the plant. Could you discuss the rumor mill and a little bit about why it happens and what kind of effect it had on?
Well, I think it's human nature to some degree to gossip. Like I said, I'm not going to say I never have. You have to catch yourself. It's really hard to say, shoot, I shouldn't be repeating that. Because too often, out of boredom, people will relay information, whether it's factual or not. Or you get dragged into a discussion. Oh, really? I couldn't believe that. Or her, blah, blah, blah. But the seed is already planted. There may not be any truth to it. And it just goes. It just goes like wildfire. I don't know if that's human nature or out of boredom. It happens that way. And so that's what makes it so unfortunate that you might have well-qualified, well-intentioned people that are destroyed by this smear campaign with no factual basis. And it's unfortunate because I think the membership suffers.
Marilyn Coulter.
And not to actually make a comment on your interview, but it's like the rumors, unfortunately, are anything from we're going home early on a hot day.
Sure.
Based on nothing to destroying someone's career.
Right.
Based on a lie, because it's easier to believe a lie than it is the truth.
Sure it is.
And regardless of what good you have done.
And how do you always, throughout history, so it must be human nature, how does white people suppress blacks? How did white people suppress Italians? When my father told me the story of being an Italian, that he couldn't go on the south side of town, and I was absolutely flabbergasted. Why? It was like, because we're Italian. I should have just understood that. Well, how does everybody who wants to be in power suppress the next person? It's by blasting them, putting them down. Makes you feel like you're bigger and better. And it's the same thing in the rumor mill. If you want to get ahead and you can't stand on your own 2 feet, what do? You blast the next person.
Make the person out to be a monster.
Right.
Renita, is there anything that we've not asked you that you'd like to share with us?
No, I've seen an awful lot of changes over the years. Some of them are for the better. They're an improvement. But an awful lot of it, I think we've gone way backwards. I wish we would get back to our strength, to our roots, to the integrity behind it, to saying what we mean what we say, representing the people. We don't represent management. We don't care. When in 96 or so, I started hearing the term, well, you know, management has the right to manage from union representatives. Before that, our attitude was, no, they don't. We'll manage, you know. And to me, that's a better way to go. You're representing your people if you take their side every time.
Marilyn Coulter.
One thing with, and it's just coworkers, and through your time being there at the plant, has there been coworkers who have become like family that has impacted you and you've extended it outside of the work site? Do you look at your fellow brothers and your workers as family?
I don't know if this is everybody's experience or if it's just mine. When I make a friend, almost invariably they're friends forever. I've had people, now I haven't been in an elected representative position since 96, and I still get phone calls at home over issues. I knew you'd know, Artie's. Would you look up for me? You know, and I don't mind that at all. I like doing that for people, and I do socialize with a lot of people outside of work. It wasn't just you're my coworker, but I don't like you, because there's very few people I did over the years that I don't like. And the ones that I make it very well known that I don't like are people with no integrity. So, yeah, I've kept a lot of relationships for years and years.
Cheryl McCoy, Renita, Fisherbody and Lansing have been considered the capital of quality. I guess I'd like to know why do you think that? Why do you think we are the best?
I think we always have been the best from the day I hired in, like we talked a little bit earlier. I remember my preconceived notion that, well, they were lazy, overpaid, beer-swizzling losers. That was what I was told before I ever hired in. Well, immediately I looked around and I watched the job people were doing or trying to do, and they had such a good work ethic. If anything, and once I got in a position to blast management about this, I would tell management that if there's any quality problems, it's because you hold people back. People point out to you, hey, you know, the windshield's not fitting properly. Instead of you getting a hold of fab and saying, hey, this frame is off, you say just put shims in it or put extra urethane in it. And a year or so down the road, the thing is leaking or wind leaks or air leaks. The people were always pointing stuff out, a better way to do it, and management wouldn't listen. Their goal has always been get it off the end of the line, get it off the end of the line. And even though they've so-called made all these changes, just-in-time delivery, and that's talking out of two sides of your face, because at the same time they added lines up in 17-2 to hold more, to bank more cars. They added banks in the body shop. So their goal is still to get that car off the end of the line, car off the end of the line, even though you're supposed to be able to stop the line and fix stuff. They've got so many banks built in so as to not stop production. And if they would have listened to people 20 years ago, 25 years ago, I don't think they'd be in the bind they're in now.
Thank you so much, Renita.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.